From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jonathan Horn is my guest, a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush and a commentator for MSNBC and BBC Radio. Jonathan Horn has written a new book about Robert E. Lee. The book is The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. Jonathan Horn, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the connection between Lee and Washington, and how did that form the basis of your book?
Well, I think most people don't realize that Robert E. Lee's father was a man named Light Horse Harry Lee, who had served under George Washington during the Revolution. But what he's most famous for is that he wrote the famous eulogy for George Washington, where he called Washington first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, which, of course, are still the words that we most associate with George Washington. And then Robert E. Lee married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son in June 1831, and that connection was what ultimately sealed the Lee-Washington connection. And these connections were so influential that on the eve of the Civil War, leaders on both sides actually saw a tremendous significance in them.
They recognized that Robert E. Lee, were they thinking that Lee could be more than just a general, that he could be president?
Well, I think what happened was that leaders on both sides saw a tremendous symbolism in Lee's connections to Washington because, for example, an emissary for Abraham Lincoln actually calls Lee to Washington in April 1861. This is just as the Union is unraveling, and says, basically, we want you to lead the main Union army to crush secession, and the country looks to you as the representative of the Washington family. So here's Lee being appealed to save the Union George Washington forged as the representative of the Washington family. And Lee actually personally is opposed to secession, and he believes that George Washington himself would have opposed secession. But he declines the offer because he can't imagine going to war against his native state of Virginia.
Well, that brings up some interesting questions about Lee. I mean, why would an American take up arms, even though he can't imagine taking up arms against his state, why would he take up arms against his country to defend both secession and the right to own slaves?
Right, and that's, of course, the big question. Even in Lee's own time, people were asking this question. When Lee told people that he was opposed to secession, but that he had learned that his first duty was to Virginia, some people asked themselves, hadn't George Washington, in his farewell address, said to prize the Union above all sectional allegiances? But Lee did feel this sense of obligation. He said he had always been taught from the earliest age that his first duty was to Virginia. And in some way, because he did love the Union and he did oppose secession, his decision to fight against the Union very much represented his decision that he was denying himself something. And this was very consistent with Lee's personality. All throughout his life, he felt he could not have his own way. And in this case, he decided he was going to have Virginia's way.
Now, I think kind of the popular belief has always been that Robert E. Lee, although he was a Southern general, was opposed to slavery as well as being opposed to secession, and that in his own words, you know, he had said things that were anti-slavery. But your book has him, you know, well, you tell us.
Right. So I think we have to be careful about the way we word Lee's belief on slavery. He certainly thought that slavery was an evil institution. That said, he was no abolitionist. He prayed for a day that God would end slavery, but that conveniently excused him from any personal responsibility in the matter. And what's so strange, I think, to your listeners today is that Robert E. Lee thought that slavery was actually worse for whites than for the slaves themselves.
Why? Because why would it be worse for whites?
Well, basically, he felt that it made whites dependent on slaves, and it also, he felt that it was a burden to have to take care of the slaves. And this is going to be incomprehensible to your listeners today, and it's just very hard for us to understand. But what actually most entangled Robert E. Lee in the institution of slavery was that in 1857, his father-in-law, who, as I mentioned, was George Washington's adopted son, died and left a will naming Robert E. Lee as executor of estates that actually included slaves who had descended from Mount Vernon. And so Lee, on the eve of the Civil War, is actually managing estates that include slaves descended from Mount Vernon.
I'm sure you've been to Mount Vernon, but I don't know if all of our listeners have been. There's at Mount Vernon, there is a grave for the president and his wife. And then up the hill, there's just a big, field where they buried all the slaves.
Right. And so George Washington had famously freed all of his own slaves in his will. But what he couldn't do, even though he wanted to do it, was emancipate his wife's slaves. And some of those slaves became the property of George Washington's adopted son, because George Washington's adopted son was also his wife's biological grandson. I know these connections can be confusing, but fortunately the book has a family tree.
Yeah, you got a nice family tree in here. And obviously you've done a tremendous amount of research for this book, because the notes take up almost as much as the text. You really put a lot of effort into researching it all. So, Jonathan Horn, what did you determine specifically that made Lee such a great general?
Well, Lee had a real talent for seizing the initiative in the battle. Even when his forces were outmanned and outgunned, he somehow always found a way, it seemed, to take the offensive. But what's so interesting when you actually read Lee's letters is he never had this feeling about himself. He always felt that he had no choice, that he had to take this move, and it wasn't a stroke of brilliance. It was just simply the only option open to him. He had to play this very daring, risky game. Now, the other side of Lee's reputation is that he was also a master on the defensive. He really helped pioneer what would become known as trench warfare. And that goes back to his training as an engineer. He was part of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a long time.
Can you give us something that we can wrap our heads around, like a specific example of each? Like, for instance, offensive, where he took the offensive. Can you give an example in a battle where he did something remarkable?
Sure. So I think if you look at, for example, when Robert E. Lee finally takes command of Virginia's forces, of the Confederate forces, and we have this perception that Robert E. Lee entered the Civil War and was immediately in charge of all Confederate forces, and that wasn't the case. In fact, Lee really struggled in his opening campaigns. His plans were sometimes way too complicated, and it's not until 1862, when George McClellan, the Union general, is closing in on Richmond, that the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, who's the president of the Confederacy, turns to Lee and puts him in charge of what's going to become known as the Army of Northern Virginia. And so as McClellan is closing in, Lee basically takes a good portion of his army, while leaving only a small portion guarding Richmond, and throws it against one small part of the Union Army. And he's able to really knock George McClellan off balance, and McClellan basically starts retreating away from Richmond because he panics. Now, on the flip side, of course, we think about Pickett's Charge as one of Lee's great military disasters. And that really was born out of a sense of frustration. Lee felt that he had to destroy the Union Army because he felt that he had to snap the North's will to fight before the South had its social order shredded.
Oh, and so can you give an example of a defensive, or that was a disaster, but a defensive move that was not a disaster? I mean, it seems like the Civil War, there was pretty much every battle was a disaster. There was so much incredible carnage.
Right. I mean, so, for example, at the Battle of Antietam in 1862, Lee's forces are tremendously overwhelmed. He's facing George McClellan again, and he's so overwhelmed that George McClellan, if he had just thrown all the Union soldiers at once against Lee's force, he could have basically thrown him into the Potomac River. But what Lee's able to do, because McClellan attacks in different segments, he first attacks on the far right, then he attacks on McClellan's far right, then in the middle, then on his left, and Lee is able to shuttle troops back and forth to stop these attacks. And he is able to make Antietam, the Battle of Antietam, a stalemate. It's also, of course, the bloodiest day in American history.
And how did Lee feel about all of that? Personally, how did he feel about all of the large numbers of deaths that occurred on both sides?
So, as I said, he is committed to this vision of destroying the Union Army. He feels that's the only way to win the war. So we shouldn't think that he was apologizing for Union casualties. He wanted to inflict as much damage as he possibly could. At the same time, after the Battle of Gettysburg, he looks at the carnage, and he says he wishes he could never have to hear the sound of a bullet again.
Yeah. Did he have political ambitions? Did he think, when this thing is over, I will be the second president of the Confederacy?
Certainly not. He very much did not like politics. Even before the war, he had a vision that politicians were only in this for their own good, and they didn't care about the welfare of the actual country. So he took a very dim view of politics. I do think, had he made the other decision, and had he succeeded and he had saved the Union and fought with the Union, it's not too much to think that maybe he would have been president of the United States in 1868. But of course, Lee decided to fight against the Union, and the person who didn't save the Union, Ulysses S. Grant, is the one who ends up becoming president in 1868. And there's an amazing moment in American history when, after the war, Robert E. Lee visits the White House and meets the new president, Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah, what was that like?
We don't know a lot about the meeting, but we can just only speculate what Lee must have thought during that short meeting between the two.
Yeah, that must have been something. I'm fascinated by horses, and you do mention Traveler a few times in your book. And I wonder, since you did so much research, what can you tell us about that horse and about Lee as a horseman?
Well, Lee was a great horseman, and he had a good eye for horses, and Traveler was his most trusted horse. It wasn't his only horse. And actually, if you go to Washington and Lee University today, and that's where Robert E. Lee is buried, and it's in Lexington, Virginia, Traveler's grave is just a few steps away from Robert E. Lee's grave.
Huh. Well, speaking of politics, you were a speechwriter for the President of the United States. Now, I've seen your picture. I've seen you on television. You look to me to be about, I'm just going to say, maybe 19, 20 years old. So how did a 7-year-old boy become speechwriter for a President of the United States?
Well, I'm not sure I can defend your math quite there. I'm a little older than you think. They haven't let 7-year-olds start writing the president's speeches, so far as I know. I got the opportunity because I'd been writing for a cabinet secretary, and a spot opened up at the White House, and I was lucky enough to get that spot, and it was a great honor. And you're able to learn so much about history by watching a president make decisions, and it really is, in some ways, just terrific training for writing a history book.
But I imagine that's a pretty great credit to have on your resume. But still, I want to know more about that experience. How did it, what was the when you went in the job interview, did you meet the president then, or when did you meet him, and how did he, what was your relationship like with him, and so forth?
Well, as I said, I didn't meet him in my job interview because I was very young when I first got the job. But as I went on, I did have a lot of time be able to spend time with the president. He personally gave edits. He was very involved. You would get a phone call from the president sometimes with edits. You would get called into the Oval Office frequently for editing sessions. And really, I think there's a misconception that a speech belongs to the speechwriter. It really is the president's speech in the end.
Well, I'm curious about that process. So, Jonathan Horn, did they say, listen, the president is... What would be an example of a speech that you wrote that you can remember? I mean, I don't mean recite the speech, but an occasion in which he helped write a speech.
Right. Well, as I said, all the speeches belong to the president, so I don't ever like to take credit for anything.
Oh, right.
But I think what I would say, though, is the way the process works is the president, you figure out about an event, and if it works perfectly, if it works right, you get input from the president right away about what it is he wants to say to this audience. And you go then write a draft. All editors from across the executive branch of government, all the president's advisors are going to weigh in on that draft. And that's one of the hardest parts about writing a speech. It isn't so much about writing the first draft. It's taking all this advice you get and incorporating that advice into the speech. And then, of course, the president had edits, and the president was a very tough editor. He was probably about the toughest editor I've ever had.
And how much of the input you've gotten all of these people telling you what needs to be in the speech, essentially, and then how much of it is you? I mean, you're obviously going to be the one who's the wordsmith, but What about your own personal political beliefs?
That's not, I mean, maybe some speechwriters do that, but I never had that experience. The speech really never reflected, I mean, you want to write for someone that you believe in, of course, but you really are serving their goals. You're writing a speech they would write if they had time to write it themselves. So it's not really about expressing your beliefs. It's capturing the beliefs of the person who's been elected president. No one votes for a speechwriter. They vote for a president.
And so did you have like a White House office? How long did your term of your tenure there last?
Well, I had an office in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. And I should say, the president has more than one speechwriter. I was never the chief speechwriter. The chief speechwriter to the president has an office, typically speaking, in the West Wing.
Yeah. And so you sort of answered to that person.
Right. That person is the boss of all the speechwriters. But there's too many speeches just for there to be one speechwriter, and that's the case in every White House today.
So how old were you when you started working for President Bush?
I'm going back. I'm doing that. I think I was. I must have been 24 or 25. But you know, it's funny. There are some speechwriters who are older, and I was the youngest speechwriter on the staff.
Yeah.
But it's not unusual for speechwriters to be young. I know President Obama's first speechwriter, first chief speechwriter was, I think, only around. He couldn't have been much older than I was. So that gives you a sense that I mean, because in some sense, it's you have to learn how to be able to change your writing style to adapt to somebody else. And if you're very young, it's easier to be able to shift your writing style.
Well, did you share the politics of President Bush? Do you still look back on his presidency as a successful one?
I do, and I really admired, to be perfectly honest, I really admired President Bush as a person. He was just such a decent person. He was such a great person to work for, and I thought he really, led this country with a lot of courage. And one of the great parts about speechwriters, though, is I think speechwriters across political parties, we have a group called the Judson Welliver Society that includes Democratic speechwriters and Republican speechwriters from different White Houses. And everybody gets together, and it's sort of not political. I know that's hard to believe, but you just share stories about what it's like to work for the president, and everyone kind of has similar experiences and similar stories, and it's a place where everyone sort of puts their political differences aside.
So how did you find George W. Bush? You know, we know him as the president, but how did you find him as a person, and was he nice to you, and would he... I don't know, would he joke around with you, or what kind of a relationship did you have?
Well, he was a great person to write for, because you never had to guess what it was he wanted to say. He would tell you directly, and you had a good sense of how he arrived at his decisions. And so much of writing a speech is explaining how you got to a decision, and so you didn't have to guess what his values were. And that made it very easy to write speeches for him.
And if the next president is a Bush, do you think you'll be back writing speeches again?
Oh, I don't think anyone is thinking of me that way right now. I'm so absorbed in the 19th century, I'm afraid that I'm quite far away from the politics of the 21st century.
Yes. Well, let me ask you about that. So you were saying that we're talking with Jonathan Horne, by the way, and his new book is called The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. So after the Civil War was over, how did Lee justify his role in the defense of slavery or the defense of the Confederacy, if he had to justify it?
I'm glad you asked the question. Lee never wrote a memoir, but he did subtly shift his views. As I mentioned, before the war, he said that he believed secession was illegal and that the Founding Fathers would have opposed it. After the war, he sort of did what we might call a flip-flop, where he began saying maybe secession wasn't illegal and maybe the Founding Fathers wouldn't have been opposed to it. So he did change his views, and that was a rationalization that probably had to take place. That said, he told everybody who asked that they should accept the results. The war had forever settled this constitutional issue, and that secession had been decided to be illegal. And he encouraged people to raise their children to be Americans.
And how long after the Civil War did he live?
He lived for 5 years after the Civil War, and what happens is after Appomattox and he surrenders, a little college in the Shenandoah Valley sends a representative to Lee and says, will you accept the presidency of what is then known as Washington College? And it's known as Washington College because George Washington had endowed it very early in its history. But most people thought Lee would turn down this offer because the college had been destroyed during the Civil War. It was in terrible shape, and it certainly wasn't worthy of the South's most famous citizen. But Lee decides to accept this offer because for 4 years he's led the young men of the South in war, and now he feels that he has an obligation to prepare them for peace and to help them rebuild the South's economy, and he can see no better way than being the president of a college. And today, of course, we know this institution as Washington and Lee University.
And how was he treated in death? That is, what were the national eulogies like?
So in the South, there's a wide, people from across the South say, memorialize Robert E. Lee as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, which of course were the same words that Robert E. Lee's father had used to eulogize George Washington. And then there's a feeling that maybe the country has forgiven Lee, and actually a senator makes the mistake of introducing a resolution to restore Arlington House, which is where Robert E. Lee had lived before the war, but it subsequently during the war had been turned into the cemetery that we know today, and says, let's restore this house to the Lee family. And senator after senator stands up and says that Lee was a traitor and they do not support this. So in time, I think some of the bitterness against Lee healed because people would say that he did help bring the country back together after the war. But his reputation has gone up and down and up and down at different periods in our time, in our history.
So he wasn't universally praised then. What did the New York Times obituary say? Did you happen to look that up?
I did look at the New York Times obituary. The New York Times did give him some credit for his post-war conduct. But that wasn't a universally felt feeling in 1870 when Lee died, because there was still a lot of bitterness about how many people had died defending a union that Robert E. Lee would not defend. It wasn't until much later, or not much later, but it wasn't until later that there became this idea that you put aside the cause for which people fought and you honor the way they fought. And I'm not sure that continued into our own time. I'm not sure. I think Lee's reputation actually is not as high now as it would have been 50 years ago, for example.
Now, you were just saying a few minutes ago that you're more involved in the 19th century than the 21st. So I'm assuming that you're going to continue writing. What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I want to keep writing about American history. I hope to do this again. I've had more fun writing this book than anything else I've ever done. And I want to write another story about the 19th century. I haven't exactly decided what it is yet, but I'll be sure to let you know as soon as I get it.
Well, that's good, because I'm going to want you back here on From the Bookshelf. Your current book is called The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. My guest, the author, Jonathan Horn. Jonathan, thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Jonathan Horn. His new book, The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, Robert E. Lee's Civil War and His Decision That Changed American History. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.